With the 14th chapter, we discussed the first part of the 14th chapter, where Krishna first glorifies the knowledge that he is going to give, then he talks about how the soul gets entangled to material existence, and then after that he talks about how the three modes bind us. So that basic defining characteristics he talked about. So now we will discuss about how those modes influence us, and when a particular mode is predominant, what are the characteristics that manifest in a particular person? Sarvadvareshu dehesmin, sarvadvareshu dehesmin. Prakasha upajayate, Jnanam yada tada vidyat, Vivruddham sattvam ityuta. So, here there are two words, Jnanam and Vidyad. They are two distinct. Jnana is referring to the dwara. So, when the sarvadareshu dehesmin, when the doors to the body, that is the senses, they are illumined, prakasha upajayate, when illumination arises in them, what is that illumination? That illumination is of knowledge. So when that knowledge, when such a situation happens, at that time, you should know, Arjuna, so you should know, that refers to vidyad. So there are two, jnanam and vidyad may seem synonyms, but they are different things. When knowledge arises, you should know that at that time, vivruddham sattvam ityuta. At that time, the mode of goodness is predominant. Now, in a sense, light or illumination is connected only with the sense of the eye. Light goes into the eye. And you know, if light goes into the air or the mouth, it doesn't make any difference. So here when Krishna is talking about sarvadvareshu prakasha, he is using prakasha not in a literal sense, but in a representative sense. In a slightly somewhat metaphorical sense, where prakasha represents the knowledge of discrimination. That means there are the senses. Now what should go inside the senses, what should come out of the senses? That essentially determines our interaction with the world. Now, how do we interact with the world? It is. A lot of things may happen inside our heart, but it is primarily through our karmendriyas and jnanendriyas that we interact with the world. So, in the mode of goodness, that interaction of the soul with the world is rooted in knowledge, is based on knowledge. And essentially, I didn't mention earlier because I have talked about this in our Ishopanishad classes. What are the modes? The modes are the subtle forces that shape the interaction between matter and consciousness. I'll repeat this. What are the modes? The modes are the subtle forces that shape the interaction between matter and consciousness. And how does this happen? This happens through the subtle body. So the modes primarily act on the subtle body, on the mind. And through that, so if we have, this is the soul, this is gross matter, and between is subtle matter. So subtle matter is the root by which spirit and gross matter interact. So that is, root means the pathway. So if from say here to go downstairs, the root is the staircase. But when I want to go down, the root alone is not adequate. Along with the root, there has to be some force which pushes me down or pushes me up. So there has to be a root and there has to be a force. Then there is motion. So between matter and consciousness, when there is an interaction, the root for that is subtle matter. And the force that brings about that interaction are the modes. Now the modes act primarily through the subtle body. So that means if I push somebody over here, my pushing won't cause that person to go down. It'll just be pushed over here only. So where the root is, that's where the primarily the force has to act. Then there will be some sort of movement. So the modes act primarily on the mind. Now we may say that it is said that gross objects are in the three modes. For example, we may say that certain animals are in goodness, passion, ignorance. Certain places are in goodness, passion, ignorance. What that essentially means is that those places induce a particular kind of force on those particular objects exert a particular kind of force on the living entity. So that's why when I say if a brothel is in the mode of ignorance, and what does that mean? That means that in that place, see, sex itself need not be in the mode of ignorance. Sex is characteristic of the mode of passion. But when sex is done flouting the principles of dharma, and that time it becomes an activity of the mode of ignorance. So you remember earlier today morning I mentioned that actually dharma has to be foundational for everything. So that's why brothels, they are considered to be brothels or alcohol or bars and such places are considered to be in the mode of ignorance. So busy metropolitan cities, city stations or bus stops or squares or marketplaces, they are considered to be in the mode of passion. And say libraries and other places of say education or natural scenic spots, they are in the mode of goodness. The temple of course is transcendental. So what does this mean when we say the places are there in particular modes? It essentially means that at that particular place the vibrations are such that they exert that kind of force on the mind. So now I can even be in a place like say CST station where people are just rushing around, the trains are going here and there, and there are announcements and there is so much noise and buzz, and it's possible that I can still stay in goodness, but the circumstances will push me towards passion. So like that. So what are the modes? The modes are the subtle forces. Yeah. Shape the interaction between gross matter, you can say, gross matter and consciousness through the root of subtle matter. Yeah, good. So example, so root is like the staircase and modes are the forces that push us up, forces that push up and down. Now, when we talk about the modes, this is in the realm of concept. Now, concept does not necessarily mean that it is unreal. No, generally, in normal language, you say this is a concept and this is an object. So object means that which you can see, touch, tangible. Anything that is gross is called as an object. And anything which is abstract is called as a concept. So are the modes concepts or are they objects? Concepts. Okay. Yeah. Modes are concepts because... Yeah. Yes, they may be accepted in different, exhibited in different ways. They may be subject to how they influence other people. So they have many of the characteristics of what we could call as concepts. Now, for example, we may say that okay, Sikhs have a particular conception of God. They have a particular concept of dharma. Buddhists have a particular concept of dharma. So concept means what is formed in the mind. That doesn't necessarily mean it is false, but the way the word concept is used, it is said that it is not as objectively real as what we consider gross objects to be. Now, this is the normal understanding. Now, you know, you may have heard this phrase, mind over matter. Mind over matter means you should use your mind to control material things. That's the idea. So now, actually, mind over matter may be a common phrase outside, but from the Vedic perspective, you cannot really have mind over matter, because mind is also matter. You know, mind is also matter. So from our perspective, mind is also a thing. And that's why when we talk about concepts, because concepts are formed in the mind, that's why it's also a thing. You know, that's why in Jaiva Dharma, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Jaiva Dharma is a novel written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And in that, there is a conversation between a Muslim, between a Maulvi Mullah and a Vaishnava Goswami. And when they are having a discussion, so the according to Islamic theology, the association of any material, ascription or association of any material form to God is considered to be shirk. Shirk means it's a great blasphemy of God. So then they are having a discussion, and he says, what is the basis of this idolatry? So he says, no, there's a form of God which is given in scripture, and according to it, this is this form of the deity is Shiva. He says, but instead of ascribing a form like material form like this to God, isn't it better to think of God in the mind itself? So the Vaishnava Goswami replies, but even the thought in the mind is material. Even the thought in the mind is material. Because as long as I am in the material world, and I am using the physical body and the material mind to think and act, I cannot avoid matter. So even the thought in the mind, the original consciousness of the soul, can think purely. But when we are interacting with matter, when our consciousness is rooted into matter, then our thoughts also become material. So now, what do you mean by material thoughts? You remember yesterday I gave the example of a video game played with virtual reality. So now this person who is playing the video game, he has the capacity to look at other places and think independent of the virtual reality. But when that person is focusing on the virtual reality and thinking of the game that is being played over there, then all the thoughts that are connected with the virtual reality, by which his consciousness is rooted within the virtual reality, all those thoughts are also virtual. So the person is not virtual, the person is real. But the thoughts which are connected with that particular video game, especially those thoughts by which the person is getting completely engrossed in it, those thoughts are virtual. The origin of those thoughts is real. That is a real conscious person. But those thoughts, because they are considered connected not with the actual reality but with the virtual reality, they are also virtual. So like that, the Atma is spiritual. But the thoughts that the Atma has, especially when those thoughts are connected with the material world, they are material. And that's why in the 13th chapter, in verse 7, we discussed how Krishna says, Ichha dvesha sukham dukham sanghatas chetana adhrutiv etat kshetram samasena savikaram udharutam. So he classifies Ichha dvesha sukha dukha and even chetana as a transformation of the modes, as a transformation of the kshetra. That means he classifies all these as material because they are connected with the material world. So the point which I am making over here, connected with our discussion, is that when we are in the material world, we cannot avoid material thoughts. So the best we can do is that our thoughts may be material, but we can choose them with the discrimination. So in the material realm, those thoughts which elevate us spiritually, we can choose those thoughts and avoid those thoughts which degrade us further. So when that discrimination is present, at that time a person is said to be in the mode of goodness. So now Krishna is telling that he is giving a very generic characteristic. Krishna is not telling, okay, these particular objects are in goodness or passion, ignorance. He will talk a little bit about it in the 17th chapter. You know, he'll talk about ahara and tapa and those sort of things, which are in the three modes. Here he is giving broad principles. So when we are conscious and discriminating, at that time we are in the mode of goodness. You know, I'm just writing an article, so it is, I don't know, pause is an action word. pause is an action word. Normally we think pause means to not do any action. But actually sometimes inaction is the best action. Sometimes if I'm angry with someone and if I speak at that time, I can just make a mess of my relationship, complicate the problem. So at that time, to pause requires a tremendous amount of willpower. So pause is an action word. And the capacity to pause actually can be, it doesn't always have to be, but can be a sign of the mode of goodness. Because I understand this time I should not speak these things, because things will become worse. Similarly, when impulses start controlling us and they impel us towards some sort of sense gratification, at that time pause. So pause is an action word. And that action is generally in the mode of goodness. Of course, if it's a perpetual pause, then it will be laziness. And that will be in the mode of ignorance. But as they say in English, look before you leap. Isn't it? That's the exact opposite of the modern value. Just do it. Isn't it? So just do it is in the mode of passion. And look before you leap is in the mode of goodness. So the Srila Prabhupada will write later in one of the purports here in the 14th chapter that in the past, progress was considered according to standards of mode of goodness. That means the more elevated a person in the mode of goodness, the person in the civilization would be considered more progressive. But now, progress is determined by the mode of passion. That means the more wealthy, the more powerful, the more materially showy a person is, the more influential, the more famous that person becomes. And this is evident even in the thought systems of people. Now, around 2500 years ago, Plato and Socrates, they are considered to be the greatest among the thinkers of Greece. And Plato said that, he said knowledge is truth. When you acquire knowledge, then you come to understand what is truth. So at the start of the scientific age in 16th century, there was a thinker, Francis Bacon. He said, what is the truth doesn't matter. Knowledge is power. His idea is that whatever gives us power, that is knowledge. And the purpose of knowledge is not to understand the truth, because his idea was what the truth is, nobody can know. What we can do is we can try to control things. And actually, Bacon was one of the primary thinkers who envisioned the age of technology. Even in Western civilization, the craftsmen and the intellectuals were considered to be two distinct categories of people. And the craftsmen were considered much lower. And the intellectuals were much higher. But through the idea that knowledge is meant to control things, technologists, those who could make mechanisms by which things could be controlled, they became elevated to the level of intellectuals. So, is this difference clear? See, the idea of knowledge is, I have to think, analyze, classify, and get to the truth. So, that is the understanding of knowledge. So, and this is the characteristic in the mode of goodness. Later on, we will see in 18th chapter that knowledge is also in three modes, goodness, passion, ignorance. So, knowledge in the mode of goodness is concerned with truth. What actually is it? Is it like this? Is it like this? Try to understand what is the truth. So now, even what is the truth, we may not get a conclusive understanding unless we take shelter of scriptural revelation. But still, the attempt to go towards the truth itself is indicative of goodness. There is a story that Euclid was a famous mathematician. And especially he is considered a pioneer of geometry. So Euclid was teaching geometry to his students. And one student came along and he was talking about the mathematical theorems and things like that. So he says, what is the use of this? One of the students asked him. So Euclid called one of his servants. He says, give him a dime. He says, without a dime, he doesn't see the use of any knowledge. Dime means money. So if there is no money in it, he cannot see any use for this knowledge. So this whole idea that knowledge is meant for some materially utilitarian gain. Either it is for directly controlling the nature around us, or as it is more commonly, for earning a living. Now, before the start of the, before say the almost the 1950s, you know, there are many thinkers, even Western civilization, and all of them said that the purpose of education is the development of the character. The purpose of knowledge, education, is the capacity for thinking. The purpose of education is the understanding of the wonder of nature. And that was the more, they, like this, they all had different notions, but they were more sattvic in the sense that it's knowledge for the sake of illuminating and developing a person. But since the 1950s, there's the whole economy became, no, the whole education became commercialized. Actually speaking, no, before the, now I'm talking about Western civilization, I'll come to Indian Vedic civilization a little later, but I'm just elaborating about how the society has gone towards the mode of passion. So education was primarily a religious or a philosophical pursuit. In the Vedic culture, the Gurukuls were primarily meant for spiritual education. Along with that, they also gave some material education. But they were intrinsically connected with spiritual education. Even in the West, the centers of learning traditionally were the seminaries which were established by the churches. So actually, if you look at most of the universities, either in America, which are famous now, or in Europe, they were all started by the churches. You know, either the Protestants started it or the Jesuits started it. Jesuits are the scholarly wing of Catholic Christians. So all these universities were actually meant for primarily theological learning. Until 500 years ago, actually, theology was considered to be the queen of all branches of learning. Because among all branches of knowledge, God was considered to be the highest object to be known. And the subject which enables us to know God, that was considered the highest. But, so actually when the educational institute is producing theologians, producing philosophers, producing thinkers, then there is very little commercial motive in that education. Now, either for the students who are going in or for those who are supporting that education. Now, it's more either of, as I said, philanthropic and illuminating motive is there. But when, through the ideas of Francis Bacon and subsequent thinkers, the knowledge was redefined as not the quest for truth, but the quest for power. At that time, the universities, from that, this was in the 16th century, and it was a gradual process that happened. But over a period of time, the purpose of the universities was not, was changed not to the understanding of the truth, but to the development of technology for gaining better control. And because the universities largely became centers for catering to the interests of the industry, the education became more and more commercialized. And in fact, now today, if people are going to talk about their colleges, now one of the prime attractions which a college touts and which students look for is, what is the salary that I am going to get if I get a degree from this college? Isn't it? And the whole principle behind education getting commercialized is that this education which we have has got practically nothing to do with truth. That's not the purpose at all. The purpose of the education is just earning, learning for earning, that's all. There is nothing more. And why has this happened? Because in the mode of passion, knowledge gets redefined from what to what? The quest, instead of the, it is not the quest for truth, but the quest for power. Yes. And now, surely for material things also education is required. Now somebody has to do management, somebody has to operate technology. the education is required for that, and that education is also important, but that is not considered the highest of all education, and that is not considered to be the success of education. And nowadays in many schools they are having value education as one additional subject, but actually originally the purpose of education was values. So now value education is just an additional one subject that comes up later. So now today, if a president or a president of a nation or the chancellor of a university, or they say, exhort the students, you must study well, otherwise you will not get a job. And that is considered a perfectly valid reasoning. And nobody asks the question, okay, is studying meant just for getting a job? That's what they think. And what happens because of this is, education gets devalued further. Because when education is only for the purpose of earning, then if somebody has some good business skills, then those people can find that I can earn without education also. And many times it happens that people go through 15, 20 years of education and then they get employed as subordinates in a company that has been started and is owned by somebody who is not even a graduate. So why? Because Vaishyas are not meant to be so high educated. So education was meant to produce Brahmanas. And now I'll reconnect this with Varnashram. See, the purpose of knowledge was originally search of truth, and that is the pursuit of the Brahmanas. The capacity to control things, the expertise in that is the expertise of the Shudras. You remember I mentioned this earlier, every one of the Varanas has its own speciality. Does anyone remember what are Brahmanas good at controlling, what are Vaishyas, Shudras, all of them good at controlling? So, Brahmanas are actually, their expertise is in ideas. Okay, ideas, concepts, thoughts, analysis. Kshatriyas control people. Vaishyas, animals. Of course, they produce money, but animals and plants, you know, the crops. They also take care of crops. And Shudras control things. So artisans, you know, those who manipulate things, like cobblers, you know, either they are outcasts or they are considered Shudras because they are operating on things. So now, what happened by the equalization of knowledge by redefining knowledge as the quest for control, you know, the Brahminical activity was used for a Shudra pursuit. So the Brahminical study, education is Brahminical primarily, but that was used for controlling things. And that's why today's people who are educated in today's society are not very well refined for independent thinking or for self-employment. Isn't this, after getting all the education, people have to look for a job. You know, if I have to just start earning myself, it's very difficult. What will I do? How will I earn myself? So our current education doesn't groom people to become Vaishyas. It rarely grooms people to become Kshatriyas or Brahmanas, extremely rarely. So people become Shudras by this education. And Shudras are not very good at generating money. And similarly, yes, please. Brahmanas are also not very good at generating money. They are not good at handling money. They can handle ideas. So that's why we will see today that many people who are intellectuals, they often feel, if they are truly intellectually oriented, they feel very unfulfilled in their life. Because I am doing nothing with my intellect. On the other hand, if they don't have an intellectual nature, they just have a money making. They got into the studies just because money making. Then they get frustrated otherwise because they say, I got so much education, but I am working under somebody who is earning so much more than me and who has so much less education than me. So what happens is, people's interest, if it is in earning money, the education doesn't really groom them for them that very well. And if they really want to pursue knowledge, it doesn't suit them for that also. Unless somebody wants to go into the field like research and paper publication and book writing, then the person can do some sort of educational pursuits. But even that has to be connected with practical things. Even in universities, when people get funds, they get funds for not just idealistic projects where we want to understand the truth. The money comes where? Money comes primarily for the projects. Actually, three things. You know, even if people want to do some, say, PhD projects or further research, the money comes primarily from the for defense, the weapons industry. It comes otherwise from the consumer industry. So the consumer industry, the weapons industry is basically, if you see Ahara Nidra Bhaya Maithun, it is Bhaya, defending. And the consumer is basically creating better arrangements for Ahara Nidra and Maithun. So what happened is the intelligence has become a servant of eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Instead of using the intelligence to go beyond eating, sleeping, mating, defending, intelligence is used to improve eating, sleeping, mating, defending. That is the misfortune of Kali Yuga. So when there is proper discrimination, at that time the person or the consciousness of the person is said to be in goodness. So what should I see this thing or not? Should I talk like this or not? Should I hear this or not? You may have seen those three monkeys, you know. Buramat suno, buramat bolo, buramat kaho. So that is actually to some extent indicative of goodness. But those monkeys don't know what is positive to do, you know. So it is what we shouldn't do is easy to tell, but it is difficult to apply unless we give them something positive to do. So that positive, actually Bhagavad Gita tells us, Prabhupada tells us, is actually devotional activity. The activity is connected with Krishna. But in principle, when there is a discrimination to know what to do and what not to do, then that is characteristic of the mode of goodness. Yes, Prabhu. So today we see that, for example, the internet is misused for a lot of things which only corrupt people's minds. So yes, in general, technological facilities, they should not be given indiscriminately to everyone. They should not be given indiscriminately to everyone. See the difference, somebody that we know that we sometimes compare that now there are nuclear weapons, there are better weapons in the past. For example, there was the, Prabhupada would say, Brahmastra. So precise in attacking. So yes, there was technology in the past, there was technology in the present. But there's a fundamental difference. You know, Vedic technology was supplicative. Modern technology is manipulative. Now what is the difference between supplicative and manipulative? Supplicative, supplication means prayer, worship. So Vedic technology was acquired using prayers and supplication. Even when the demons want something, how do they get it? They actually pray, they worship, they do tapasya. And that's how they get it. So Vedic technology is supplicative. Supplication basically means prayer. Modern technology is manipulative. Manipulative means we try to manipulate, fool around with nature and try to find out how we can do things better, how we can improve things. So because of this difference, in Vedic technology, just the acquisition of the technology, whether it is a Brahmastra or whether it is some Siddhi or whether it is some power, there is an implicit acknowledgement that there is some higher power. And I have to gain power from that higher power or higher being or whatever it is. Now, I may still have a manipulative motive eventually. Okay, after gaining power, I may want to overthrow that person. Like Vrukasura, he wanted to gain power for Shiva and then take Uma away from him. So, even the supplicative method can be used for manipulative purposes. But the broad mentality was that this is primarily supplicative. I understand that there are higher powers and by their grace I can get certain things. Now, the modern technology is primarily manipulative in the sense that we disconnect any higher, any acknowledgement of any higher power and just try to understand the mechanisms and try to control the mechanisms. So now even this manipulative technology can be used for supplicative purposes. In the sense that we can use internet for sharing Krishna consciousness. We can use the devices for our devotional purposes. But there is a primary mentality that is associated with particular things. So in general, the modern technology creates the feeling of being an independent controller. I can control things. So that is characteristic of the mode of passion. So when people are made to pander to their lowest instincts and they are facilitated in this by the provision of technology, then things become extremely perverse. So, you know, I wrote an article about how Kali Yuga is so dangerous. So actually Kali Yuga, it's a whole topic. I'll just mention it briefly because you have brought this topic. We're going to discuss this a little later. Now what happens is today, there is always a conflict between virtue and vice. Virtue means good and vice means bad. So in Kali Yuga, in modern times, not just in Kali Yuga, but in Kali Yuga in modern times, vice is intellectually rationalized, culturally glamorized, and technologically facilitated. So, intellectually rationalized means that yeah, this is the right thing to do. This is the right thing to do. For example, now, when people have illicit sex, one consequence can be that there is unwanted pregnancy. So then, actually, abortion is cold-blooded murder. So what is the intellectual rationalization offered for that? We want man and woman to be equal. And if nature has made woman unequal to man, then actually that is the that pregnancy by which woman becomes unequal, that is biological slavery. And abortion is the means to biological liberation. Such a perverse idea. So what is this? This is intellectual rationalization. So, you know, in the past also, say Ajamil saw some Shudrani and Shudra doing some obscene things. So, you know, that was considered to be obscene. That was considered to be degraded. But today, in movies, when there are obscene scenes, what are they called? Bold scenes. Isn't it? So, what is happening? Who wants to be bold? Who doesn't want to be bold? Isn't it? It's not actually to be obscene in public is not boldness. That is shamelessness. But the intellectual rationalization of boldness is, of this shamelessness is boldness. So when things are intellectually rationalized, then people start thinking this is the nice thing to do. Then it becomes culturally glamorized also. Culturally glamorized means, see actually even in Bollywood, till 50 years ago, not 50, maybe 80, 90 years ago, when there would be some sort of dramas and movies, the female roles would also be played by males. The female's roles would also be played by males. But because it was understood in Vedic culture that, you know, no dignified woman would want to exhibit herself in public. So that's how it was traditionally. But over a period of time, as the influence of Kali Yuga came up, actually things became more and more degraded. Till now, the women who exhibit themselves in public are become glamorous. And they become the ideals for other women to become like. And then, technologically facilitated. That's what you were mentioning. Because of, say, the... Correct, acting as a Shudra. So people have Shudra instincts, and it's made easy for them to act on the Shudra instincts. That's what makes things very perverse. So, is that clear? Okay, let's move forward. We have discussed a lot about the future verses also, especially about passion and ignorance. Lobha pravrittir arambha. Karmanamashamahaspruha. Rajasyetani jayante. Vivruddhe bharatarshabha. So Krishna describes Rajasya etani jayante, when mode of Rajaguna is predominant, Vivruddhe jayante, these are born. And he's using referring to Arjuna as bharatarshabha. The best of the Bharatas don't get consumed by this mode of passion. The first characteristic of the mode of passion is lobha. More. So, actually, in the 1970s and 1980s, there was a slogan, greed is good. Greed is good. Greed. Get more. And then that greed sort of led to the trampling of ecological resources. And now they have redefined it. Green is good. Green is good. Be eco-friendly. So, but actually the idea that greed is good, you should have more and more and more, that is a characteristic of the mode of passion. And that keeps one perpetually dissatisfied. Perpetually dissatisfied. Why do people stay dissatisfied? Because in today's society, the best of everything is presented constantly as the ideal for everyone to compare with. So the best cars, the best cell phones, the best looks, the best bodily shapes. You know, when you see the perfect male specimen, perfect female specimen, then everybody starts comparing themselves with that, and everybody starts feeling insecure. So this lobha, everybody has lobha. But actually in today's culture, that lobha is systematically induced. In fact, the whole advertising industry is a lobha generating industry. It's a greed inducing industry primarily. So gratitude comes when we feel satisfied with what we have. When we look at what we have and we feel, oh, there are so many other people who don't have, Krishna has given me so much, then I'll feel grateful. But if I'm constantly being bombarded with images of all that I don't have, then it's impossible to be grateful. So actually gratitude and greed are antithetical emotions. And that's why today's society, people find gratitude very difficult, because they just can't think of what all I have, because they are always thinking of what all I don't have. Now, lobha, and because of that, pravritti means activity. Activity according to one's nature, this pravritti and nivritti. So, people act according to their pravritti very vigorously. That itself is not bad, but arambha karmanam. They keep starting new things. Arambha means start off. So, endeavor. Sarva arambha parityagi. They do all sorts of arambha in karma. Mundane activities. And Ashamaha spruha means uncontrollable desire. Desire that just doesn't get pacified. So, to some extent, the addictions, they take birth in passion and then they drag a person down to ignorance. And how addictions can entangle people is actually one of the greatest modern tragedies in society. Now, you might have heard of organizing like Alcoholics Anonymous. So these are people who have uncontrolled in alcohol, alcoholic consumption, they try to come together and they acknowledge the power of God. They have got 12 steps by which they try to become free from alcoholism. So actually, at Alcoholics Anonymous was just one. Now there are over a dozen anonymous organizations like this. You know, there are Smokers Anonymous, Drug Addicts Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous. Overeating is a big problem for many people. There is a whole concept of sex addiction. Sexaholics Anonymous. Video games, I don't know what is the name for that anonymous. Then there is TV Addiction Anonymous. And there are so many addictions which have been artificially generated through the modern society. So, Ashamaha Spruha, uncontrollable desire. So, addiction is primarily characterized by an uncontrolled craving which one cannot give up. So there is craving, there is awareness of the consequence, but still there is continuation of the activity. So there is craving, I want to do it. Then you're told, no, if you do it, you'll get into trouble. There is awareness of consequence, but still continuation of doing. So that's the craving. And that actually is engendered by the mode of passion. Then Krishna will tell about the mode of ignorance. Aprakasho pravrittischa. Pramado moheva cha. Tamasyetani jayante. Vivruddhe kuru nandana. So, Krishna has said in the previous two verses, in 11th verse, he used the word prakash. And in the 12th verse, he used the word pravritti. So now he's describing aprakasho apravrittischa. So prakasha means illumination or discrimination. And pravritti means action. So in ignorance, there is neither discrimination nor action. Just lethargy. So pramado mohaevacha. So now, ignorant people may also act. They may act in destructive ways. But that is actually not action according to pravritti. That is just a distorted, wild action. Pramado, they are just illusion and madness. Tamasya etani jayante. So, to a large extent, video games are characteristic of the mode of ignorance. You know, in the 1980s in America, when the video games were becoming popular, some concerns were expressed that if children get too addicted to video games, then that will disturb their, will distract them from studies, and that will disturb their normal functionality. So, to suppress these concerns, the makers of video games started a new genre called educational video games. And they started this, and you know, there are educational video games which are claimed that they will accelerate your student journey. And you know, the company which started this, they called it Einstein Video Games. Because Einstein is like the icon of super intelligent person. And when they started that off, even children from the age of 3-4, you know, they are given video games to play with. And they start playing with it. And then many surveys have been done afterwards, and they have found that actually there is no documented evidence that playing those sort of video games enhances the learning capacity of the children. Rather, it affects them adversely in two ways. First is that the children, one of the major aspects of growing is learning to interact with others. Even doing simple things. Playing ball, you know, somebody hits and then I hit back, coordinating things, carrying things. So doing things with one's hands and legs, especially in a team, that is in a group, that is a very important part of growing up. But that is completely left out. And the second, more dangerous thing is that when the children get habituated to those high-tech video games, then their capacity to concentrate when the teacher is teaching in class, it becomes severely diminished. Because there are two primary things that absorb them. Either at home they are playing video games or they are watching TV. In TV, they're watching cartoons. And both the video game world and the cartoon world seems to be much more colorful and attractive than the teacher's world. And actually, the end result is that the learning capacity gets substantially reduced, not increased. But this video games for children is a multi-million dollar industry. It's huge, huge. And there is no evidence of any learning happening. But it is actually the promotion of tamoguna. And children become so terribly addicted to this. Video games are such a huge craze nowadays. And it has all become commercialized. Now, within the video games, there will be certain characters. And within those characters who are the heroes within the games, they will advertise certain products. And then the children become so... You know, they are very receptive because they allow those characters who are there in the video games. And then they say, okay, let's take Big Macs. Let's eat this. Let's go there. Then those brands also get imprinted within the minds of children. So it's Pramado Mohe Vacha. And this mode of ignorance, the way it is influencing people, is terrible. Now, Krishna here describes how... which when a particular mode is predominant. So when we don't like to think, we don't like to do anything. Just be lethargic. So that is characteristic of the mode of ignorance. Now Krishna will describe further. Okay, if one lives in a particular mode, then what will be the consequences of that? What first he will describe the long-term consequence in terms of where one will go after that.
Yata yada sattve pravruddhetu pralayam yati deha bhret tadottam vidam lokan amalan pratipadyate.
So when sattva is pravruddha and vivruddha is the same thing. Vruddha means to, vruddha can mean old, but vruddha can also mean prosperous, like samruddhi. Samruddhi is prosperity. So vivruddha and pravruddha means when that is predominant. When yada sattve pravruddhe tu, when sattva is pravruddha, pralayam. So Krishna uses the word pralaya several times for death. In the 16th chapter also he will use pralayantam upashitaha. 16th chapter. So pralayam means death. Pralayam yati deha brit. So the soul who is embodied, if he dies at that time, tad uttam vidam lokan. Vidam is those who are vidwan, known. Uttam vidam. Those who are knowledgeable, he will attain that amalan lokan, that pure lokas. So this isn't referred to liberation, this refers to the heavenly planets. So by living in the mode of goodness, one will ascend to the higher planets. Then he will talk about what happens to the people who are in the other modes. No. Is this referring to timing? Person living in the mode of goodness, if that person dies at night, then what about that? Actually, Krishna is not talking yada in terms of the time. He's talking about the psychology of the person, the consciousness of the person. These are general characteristics. Krishna is not talking anything specific in terms of external material characteristics. He's just primarily focusing on psychology over here. So, in a sense, there will be a cumulative effect of the way the person has lived throughout his life. The person has lived in goodness, then he will be more or less in goodness at the moment of death. There might be some great fear at the time of death, and some things like that might be there. But overall, the cumulative effect of the cultivation of goodness will be that the person will be relatively in goodness. Then Krishna will talk about the other two modes. Rajasi pralayam gatva
karma sangishu jayate
tatha pralinas tamasi
mudhayonishu jayate.
So rajasi pralayam, if you die in the mode of passion, karma sangishu jayate. Karma sangishu means this earthly planet itself. Those who are attached to karma. He will be born in this earthly planetary system. Now, to some extent, karma sangishu can also refer to the heavenly planets. Because there also people are attached to karma. Now, Indra is not really attached to jnana or tapasya or anything. He's interested in karma only. So if one does the karmakanda activities very well, then the person may go to heaven also. Heaven is not a place in goodness. It is also in passion. Actually, the upper planet systems, Prabhupada, that's why he will mention Uttam Vidam Lokan, Brahma Loka or Jana Loka. So Swargaloka is also in the mode of passion to some extent. And if one lives strictly according to dharma, not dharma in terms of parav dharma, but in terms of karmakandi dharma, then the person can go to the karma sangishu as heavens also. And then mudhayonishu jayate. If one lives in tamoguna, mudhayonishu means ignorant. The ignorant species. So Prabhupada translates this as animals. It can also refer to the lower planets. When a person has practically no spiritual awareness. So when nature basically acts like Krishna acts, you know, Krishna says, yetha mam prapadyante, so nature also says similarly. Okay, if you want to live in ignorance, then why do you need a human body for? Human body is meant for cultivating knowledge. Then I will give you a body which will be suited for living in ignorance. And then accordingly the person gets an animal body. Now, after that Krishna will describe. Do lower planets have enjoyment? There'll be a variation between, say, when we talk about lower planets, it is not that all the lower planets have enjoyment. Now there is Sutal, Atal, Vital, Taratal, Rasatal, Mahatal, Patal, like that. So Sutal, Vital, among the lower planets also, the upper ones are places of enjoyment. But as you go lower down, then it's not that all are places of enjoyment. And especially below all these four planetary system, there is the Narak Loka. The 27 Narakas are there. And those are places of terrible suffering. So when Krishna will later on tell that Adho Gacchanti Tamasaha, at that time when he is referring to Adho, it's not just the Patalas, it's below that to the Narakas. Yeah, lower planets can include all this, but in general, see, when we talk about upper and lower, see, first of all, upper and lower is not simple geography. Because, you know, if I just say upper, when if I am in India, I say upper, the earth is round, and if I am in America, I say upper. The two are just two different directions. So, you know, upper is not just simplest geographically upper. There is a vertical dimension in Vedic cosmology which is related with karmic qualification. The vertical dimension is related with karmic qualification. When I say upper, now in a circular sphere, what do I really mean by upper? So it's not referring to Bhuloka, it is referring to Bhumandala. When I have to say talk about upper, the reference point for upper and lower is not Bhuloka, it is Bhumandala. The whole planetary system, not just specific planet. So within that, the upper and lower is primarily in terms of better and lesser facilities for enjoyment. So it is not that all lower planets have good facilities for enjoyment. Sutal is exceptional. If the lower five planets also had very good facilities for enjoyment, then the demons would not want to conquer Swarga all the time. Swarga is much better. And the demons are not the only residents of the lower planets. They are also in the upper among the lower planets. As they go down, the conditions are not so much enjoyable. And in general, when you say that person goes down, that doesn't refer to the person is going to a destination of enjoyment. It generally refers to a person going to a destination where they will suffer. So that can refer to the lowest among the lower planets, or it can refer to the Narkas also. It doesn't refer to Sutal, Vital, those sort of planets, planetary systems. Rajasastu phalam, so karmana, okay, we'll just do this verse. Karmana sukrutasyahu sattvikam nirmalam phalam rajasastu phalam dukham agyanam tamasa phalam. So, karmana sukrutasyahu. So, in sattvaguna, one will perform sukrut karma. And what will be the result of that? Nirmalam. One will become purified. So, acting in goodness, acting according to discrimination, will purify us. And Krishna says, rajasas tu phalam dukkham. When one acts in passion, the result is misery. Actually, what is this misery? Multiple miseries are there. In the long run, the karmic consequences will be there. But even in the short run, when a person lives in passion, there is a constant restlessness, dissatisfaction, anxiety that is there, which just agitates and drains the person. So, rajasastu phalam dukkham. This is a very good sutra to remember. Rajasastu phalam, simple phrase it is. Rajasastu phalam dukkham. when as soon as a person becomes greedy, as soon as a person becomes lusty, now there is misery over there. When people, most of the time, there have been many surveys also done, you know, when people have sex, it is not that they are enjoying when they have sex. Actually, we are not talking about spiritually minded, even materialistic people. Now, over a period of time, they just get bored with sex. So that's why many times in movies and in pornography, the whole people get enjoyment when the shock bar is raised. Shock bar means you have to do something new, something dazzling. And that's why people get into more and more perversities in sex and violence. Now, there is a whole genre of extreme pornography, you know, which is just involving brutality and bestiality and all sort of horrible things. And people get used to that, people get hooked to that, because at a material level, when people try to enjoy, actually, when people engage in sensual activities, it's not that they do it because indulgence is so pleasurable. They act because resistance is so unbearable. There's a difference between the two. You know, how this rajasas to phalam dukkham? I'll explain this. How does mode of passion lead to misery? So, people engage in sense gratification not because indulgence is so pleasurable, but because resistance is so unbearable. So what happens is the mind starts torturing. Do it, do it, do it, do it. And they just want to get relief from that torment. And that's why they indulge. So what happens is, I'll just put it here. They mistake relief from torture to be pleasure. So all that happens is, lust is there, greed is there, it's tormenting, do it, get it. And when temporarily that torture stops, they think it's pleasure. But it's not actually pleasure, it's just relief. And that's why if they want to go beyond the relief and get some pleasure, what they have to do, they have to increase the shock bar. Increase the shock bar means actually the kind of violence that is shown in many of these, even the horror movies and things like that, it's very brutal at times. And why do people need to see that kind of violence? Because the normal level of whatever exposure that is there, that doesn't satisfy them. So what they have to do? To get pleasure, they have to increase the shock bar. You know, shock bar means, it means do more shocking things. That's how they try to get some pleasure. And in this way, essentially, rajasas tu phalam dukkham. Rajasas tu phalam dukkham. Actually, living in the mode of passion simply leads to misery. Misery is in terms of when will I get it? When will I get it? And even if I get it, it doesn't satisfy me. I have to get more. I have to get more. I gave a class on a topic, there's a book on this topic called Anxiety Epidemic. Anxiety Epidemic. People are living in such a terrible, relentless state of anxiety over every small thing. Every small thing. Why? There is what is called as choice paralysis. Choice paralysis means that if a person wants to go and purchase a t-shirt, you go into a shop and you find 200 t-shirts over there. And then when you have to purchase a t-shirt is not just something that you wear. A t-shirt is something that makes a statement about who you are. And then what happens is people start thinking, who am I? They don't think, who am I in terms of whether I am the body or the soul. They think, who does my t-shirt reveal me to be? And they get, this whole thing is, it's such a terrible mess. So there is an American psychologist, sociologist, he's written a book called Why Less Is More. So he says basically that, I'll conclude with this point, because how rajasastu phalam dukkham is important to analyze this. So rajas is characterized by, as I said, greed. You want more and more. So he basically classifies people into two broad categories. He says there are maximizers and there are optimizers. So who are these maximizers? They say, if I have to get anything, I have to get the best bargain in everything. They are the maximizers. So if they want to get a new cell phone, then they will inquire about all the schemes that are there with all the models. And okay, in this I can make incoming like this, it can make outgoing like this, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. And sometimes, you know, there people can spend months in just trying to find out which cell phone I should get. Now, in general, what happens with maximizers? They seek the best of everything. So, there are three consequences of this. First is that they spend huge amount of time in choosing every small thing. Of time in choosing things. And then what happens? They don't have time for other things. So ultimately the amount of time everyone has is limited. So they don't have time for relationships. They don't have time for home. They don't have time for God. You know, they did a survey and they found that an average American, the amount of time the average American spends in a shopping mall is 1,000 times more than the amount of time he spends in a church. 1,000 times, you know. So what is that? It is, when people say we don't have time, it's not that they are working 24 hours a day. Because there is so much bombardment, you know, I have to purchase this, purchase this, purchase this. So they spend so much time. Now, they spend time. Now, the second part is a positive consequence. So as compared to optimizers, they get better bargains than optimizers. Because they spend so much time in doing research, they actually get good packages. But the third problem is negative is, they stay insecure that I might just have got a still better bargain. If I had investigated a little bit more. So they stay perpetually dissatisfied. So, because of this, although they get better, still they're not satisfied. Because they think, maybe I should have inquired a little bit more. And this really creates a huge amount of unnecessary drain of energy. So on the side of optimizers, what they understand? Okay, it's not that every single choice is a matter of life and death for me. There are choices that are functional. Okay, just if I want this, I get this, move forward. So actually speaking, you know, in brahmachari life, because there is so much standardization, so much of our mental energy gets saved. You know, okay, you have to wear this dhoti kurta, you use this shaving cream, use this bath, bathing soap, use this. Everything gets standardized, then our mental energy gets so much freed for doing higher things. You say, you know, actually we say simple living, high thinking. Now, these are both principles, but to the extent our living is simple, to that extent there can be high thinking. When our living becomes complex, then all the thinking is about living only. There is no time for thinking of something higher. So in this way, people are suffering from so much anxiety. This we call it stress, we may call it tension, we may call it by whatever name. But rajasas tu phalam dukkham. And wherever the modern Western civilization is coming up, this is a general characteristic. The characteristic is that people become stress-filled. People become anxiety-ridden. People become worried about things. So, what Krishna is telling over here is the consequences of the three modes, and we'll continue this tomorrow morning. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Itai Gaur Premanande.